Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 615, titled Going Native, Part 2, German Foreign Policy and Its Implications. This has been recorded on October 21st of the year 2007. We're going to plunge right into the program, and we're going to continue with the second of a three-part series of articles from a very, very scholarly website that's providing virtually all of the material we're using in this broadcast. That website is GermanForeignPolicy.com. We've used it before. And specifically, one of the things that occasioned my selection of this particular focal point for this broadcast was the visit of the Dalai Lama to the United States this past week. George Bush was schmoozing with the Dalai Lama and conferring a very high award on him. It was actually a congressional award. And, of course, this elicited protest from China, as well one might imagine. And in the context of the broadcast, the second half of the broadcast, remember not only what you learned in the first half of the broadcast, but also For the Record programs 547, 8, 9, and 50, and also some of the material from the Alpha Male series for the record programs number 530, or maybe, anyway, the Alpha Male series. One's 570, I think the other was 530. But keep those in mind as you listen to this. And also remember, we'll touch on this on it in this broadcast, but the Dalai Lama is the opposite, the exact opposite of what he's represented as being. And this is not to be patronizing or condescending towards those who get sucked in by the big lie. How can people possibly, you know, under ordinary circumstances, grasp that something is the total opposite of what it's been represented as being? The Dalai Lama is one of those. But if it isn't impossible, it's certainly very difficult for people, certainly in the absence of good critical information, to realize the big lie and that actually things are the opposite of what they are represented as being. And we're going to take a look at the Dalai Lama's association with SS men, the strategic association between Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan, and the Dalai Lama dating back to the 30s and 40s. Just remember, he's the opposite of what he represents himself as being. According to the Tremondis, formerly the publishers of and number one German supporters of the Dalai Lama, the Dalai Lama prays on a daily basis to a Mongolian war god. It's probably why Bush had him to Washington. He was wondering if maybe the Dalai Lama would initiate him into those ceremonies so we can pray to that same war god on a daily basis. Anyway, we're going to plunge right in with the second of three articles from GermanForeignPolicy.com about German foreign policy, its association with the Dalai Lama, its geopolitical goal vis-a-vis the Earth Island of using Tibetan nationalism and Mongolian nationalism and separatist sentiment in Xinjiang province in China to basically not only break up China but to establish a German hegemonic influence in Central Asia and that part of the Earth Island. This second article from GermanForeignPolicy.com is from September 27th of 2007. Once again, it's called Strategies of Attrition, Part 2, and it reads, German politicians have announced an escalation of the Chancellor's Tibet offensive. According to comments made by the Prime Minister of Hesse, Roland Koch, Angela Merkel's meeting with the Dalai Lama is only the beginning of large-scale interference into China's internal affairs that also should incite other Western states to give up their reservations. Berlin considers the moment particularly favorable for activities to weaken Beijing because, as the host of next year's Olympic Games, the People's Republic is restricted in its capacity to retaliate. Berlin's Tibet activities are part of a cross-party general consensus and are in line with old traditions of German foreign policy that, already in the 1930s and 1940s, considered Lhasa, Tibet, as an important base for interfering in Central Asia. The German-Tibetan contacts that were established at the time have not only outlived World War II, but are still functioning today, as GermanForeignPolicy.com reports in the second part of its series focused on strategies of attrition. In a section called The Free World, we read, soon, quote, other state and political leaders will follow the Chancellor's example and intensify their support for the Dalai Lama's nonviolent struggle for more autonomy in Tibet, unquote, declared the Prime Minister of Hesse, Roland Kalk, of the CDU, only one day after Beijing rescinded its cancellation of a bilateral foreign ministers meeting, showing it was willing to relent after Germany's affront on September 23rd. Kalk declared that the Chinese government has, quote, to realize that the free Tibet world is not prepared to forget or conceal the situation of the Tibetan people, unquote. It would become more difficult, unquote, to exclude the human rights question, unquote, from the discussion on the Olympics. So-called NGOs, among them Reporters Without Borders, are launching campaigns accordingly. Their activists are organizing demonstrations in Beijing and have excellent connections to the media in Germany. This organization is known for similar campaigns against the Cuban government and does not deny having received subventions, I think what they mean is support, from U.S. sources. By the way, this article obviously, and as are the articles on GermanForeignPolicy.com, I believe are translated from the German, certainly show an initial German language authorship. So if some of the verbiage here is somewhat awkward, that's why. Continuing, in a section called Tradition, we read, the German government's Tibet policy is supported across party lines in Germany. Among the Dalai Lama's sympathizers since the 1980s are Roland Koch of the CDU, as well as many in the Green Party, and since the early 1990s, the Friedrich Naumann Foundation, closely affiliated with the liberal FDP Party. Ethnic minority group or Volksgruppen experts trained in German ethnic models from the Germanophonic Northern Italian South Tyrol are counseling the Tibetan exile government on questions of autonomy, unquote. Berlin's interference in Tibet is following, above all, the traditions of German foreign policy, which already back in the 1930s and 1940s considered Lhasa, Tibet, to be an important base in Central Asia. At the time, scientists, or so-called scientists, made expeditions into the conflict-ridden western regions of China, the Soviet Union, and Great Britain via India were also trying to gain influence. Inner Mongolia, Xinjiang, or eastern Turkestan, and Tibet were the targets. And then in a section called Caucasian Racial Element, we read some of the SS expeditions into Tibet, and those were a major focal point of For the Record 547. And in that, we took a look at how that was the genesis of the relationship between the Dalai Lama and members of the SS, including SS war criminal Bruno Beghe, which extend into the 1990s. Bruno Beghe became an associate of the Dalai Lama's and was operating under the auspices of the Tibetan government in exile as of 1994. Of the SS relationship with Tibet and the SS expeditions to Tibet in order to expand German influence in Central Asia and that part of the Earth Island, we read in a section of the article called Caucasian Racial Element, the zoologist Ernst Schaefer was one of the first protagonists of the German-Tibet research. In 1931 and 2, and from 1934 to 6, he participated in two German-American Tibet expeditions. In recognition of his services for zoological research in this area, he was promoted to SS Obersturmführer. In 1938 and 39, he led a third expedition, quote, Tibet Expedition Ernst Schaefer, under the patronage of Reichsführer SS Himmler, and in connection with the Ahnenerbe, or Ancestral Heritage, EV research branch of Berlin, unquote. The search for traces of the Aryan race, unquote, in the Tibetan mountains was one of the important objectives of the SS and Ahnenerbe expedition. A few years later, Bruno Beghe, B-E-G-E-R, one of the leading participants in the expedition, announced that he had recognized a, quote, Caucasian racial element in the Tibetan nobility, unquote. This is how the Nazi racists justified their efforts to use Lhasa as their base in Asia. The next section, Friendship, Mr. Hitler. The 1938-39 Tibet expedition established the first contacts between the governments in Berlin and Lhasa, Tibet. Quote, under the slogan of the meeting of the Western and Eastern swastika, political contacts with the Tibetan government could be made in Lhasa, unquote, according to an analysis of the Tibet research during the Nazi period. As they left for home in the summer of 1939, Ernst Schaefer and his colleagues received a letter from the Tibetan leader in which he declared that Schaefer had sought to establish closer ties between the government of Berlin and Lhasa. Your Excellency, King Mr. Hitler, we agree with your desire for mutual friendship, unquote. And this is in a letter from the Dalai Lama. Now, perhaps I'm going to reread this section. The Dalai Lama is basically selected through a quasi-mystical process in which a child, a boy, is determined to have recognized that he is, in fact, the reincarnation of the previous Dalai Lama. That happens at a very young age. Now, in this, the Dalai Lama, the current Dalai Lama, is 72, which means he was born in 1935. Now, whether these formal diplomatic letters between the SS and Nazi Germany and the Dalai Lama were authored for or written for the current Dalai Lama when he was just a little whatever, or whether this was from the older Dalai Lama, I'm reasonably sure that at this point, by 39, the young Dalai Lama would have in all probability been selected. Now, whether he was able to correspond or whether he had a mentor who handled correspondence, I don't know. But the current Dalai Lama would have been alive at this point, and this is right in the time period in which he would have been, I don't know what the term is, ordained or selected as the Dalai Lama. But again, what we're talking about here is a relationship between the SS and Nazi Germany and the Dalai Lama specifically, and as we're going to see, that relationship and German geopolitics in Central Asia has evolved into the post-war period, and we see the same kind of a relationship existing today between the Underground Reich and Germany and the Dalai Lama. Once again, under the slogan of the meeting of the Western and Eastern swastika, political contacts with the Tibetan government could be made in Lhasa, Tibet, according to an analysis of the Tibet research during the Nazi period. As they left for home in the summer of 1939, Ernst Schaefer and his colleagues received a letter from the Tibetan leader, the Dalai Lama, in which he declared that Schaefer had sought to establish closer ties between the government of Berlin and Lhasa. Quote, "Your Excellency, King Mr. Hitler, we agree with your desire for mutual friendship," unquote. The Tibetan government's effort to become more independent from the British colonial power was the motive behind the rapprochement. And then in the next section, a little sabotage. The subsequent Tibet expedition targeted London and was discussed in Berlin on September 4, 1939, one day after Great Britain entered the war. Ernst Schaefer, Bruno Breguet, and the Foreign Ministry participated in this discussion. They decided to send 30 officers of the SS to Tibet under Schaefer's command with enough weapons to arm 1,000 to 2,000 militiamen, and then they put that they planned to recruit to fight against the British in India. Schaefer was ordered to receive training in the SS Leibstandarte Adolf Hitler, unquote. By the way, the SS Leibstandarte Adolf Hitler were initially Hitler's personal bodyguards. That eventually evolved into the first Waffen-SS division, the Leibstandarte. Beginning of this last sentence again, they, the SS, decided to send 30 officers to Tibet under Schaefer's command with enough weapons to arm 1,000 to 2,000 militiamen that they planned to recruit to fight against the British in India. Schaefer was ordered to receive training in the SS Leibstandarte Adolf Hitler, unquote. "If you solve a military problem, you have first to be trained and educated as a soldier," is how the Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler explained the scientists' re-education. Again, quoting, "A little sabotage and a few explosions won't do the job," unquote. But these plans conflicted with plans to weaken British positions in Asia with the aid of Afghan allies, and they were finally dropped because of interministerial disputes in Berlin. And next is discussion of the Pan-Mongolian vassal. German plans for Tibet became topical for the last time during Nazi rule in 1942. Impressed by the Wehrmacht's advance on Soviet territory, Himmler ordered the total exploration of the Central Asian vital living space, or Lebensraum, unquote. When, in the summer of 1942, Japanese troops advanced into the region bordering Tibet, they encountered a German ally in Lhasa, the Dalai Lama. Now, at this point, 1942, the Dalai Lama would have been the current one. So basically, what we're talking about here is the current Dalai Lama when he was a little boy and an ally of the SS and Nazi Germany. Continuing, the God King's Camarilla was hoping to disengage itself from Chinese, Soviet, Russian, and British influence and to eternalize the Tibetan feudal dictatorship. The goal was to create a Pan-Mongolian Federation, unquote, under the leadership of the Third Reich and Japan. In a section called Skull Collection, Germany's endeavors both for Mongolia as well as for its activities in Tibet outlasted the war. Ernst Schaefer's collaborator, Helmut Hoffmann, became a professor at Munich University, where he set the scientific standards for the German Tibetology, unquote. In 1952, SS officer Bruno Begay set out on his next Tibet expedition. Until 1943, the same Bruno Begay pursued Mongol research in the Auschwitz death camp and accepted and assembled a collection of Asian skulls, unquote. By the way, in For the Record 547, we took a look at this. He was studying basically what the SS considered certain racial types, and he selected people who appeared to be of Tibetan or Mongolian features and had them killed and their bodies preserved for study. Some 130 some odd people were selected and done to death in that way. That's how he had his collection of Asian skulls. He killed the people to whom they belong. It's only 130, 140 murders. What the heck? What's 130 or 140 murders between friends, and particularly when anthropological knowledge is at stake? Returning to discussion of SS war criminal Bruno Begay, a longtime associate and friend of the Dalai Lama, in 1994, Begay was the Dalai Lama's official guest in London. The Dalai Lama also maintained good contacts to another protagonist of German Tibet activities, Heinrich Harrer, who had also been an SS Central Asian activist. By the way, he became the Dalai Lama's tutor, SS officer Heinrich Harrer. He was played by Brad Pitt in the movie, something like 7 Years in Tibet, I think it was called. Continuing. Harrer visited Lhasa for the first time between 1946 and 1950, where he worked as a teacher of the incumbent Dalai Lama. He has written several books on Tibet, which are still popular in Germany. When the Green Party began to reactivate German Tibet policy in the 1980s, they also used Harrer's writings. By the way, the Green Party in Germany, which is the founding element of the Green Party World War, was actually founded by a veteran of the German Nazi Party, the NSDAP. We'll perhaps go into that at some point in the future. There's a good book called Eco-Fascism, which talks about some of those interesting antecedents of the Green Party. Again, the Green Party was founded by a veteran of the Nazi Party under Hitler. Continuing, on the last part of this article, under the title of Centrifugal Forces, the mixture of ethnic ingredients containing obviously racist elements and trivial concepts about religious life in the Far East is now being enriched with questions of human rights, unquote, which serve the German geopolitical expansion policy. As in the past, the object is to use Tibet against the Chinese central state and the centrifugal forces of dozens of nationalities to wear down Beijing from the interior. In the next sequence of this series, focusing on strategies of attrition, GermanForeignPolicy.com will expose German and Japanese plans to include Mongolian allies in a joint policy against China. And we're going to go directly to that article, Strategies of Attrition, Part 3, from October 2nd of 2007, again from the GermanForeignPolicy.com website. Last weekend, parliamentarians of the Germanophonic minority in northern Italy, South Tyrol, visiting the headquarters of the Tibetan exile government in India, declared Tibet's being part of the People's Republic of China to be illegal, unquote, and called for the secession of this Western Chinese autonomous region. South Tyrolean public authorities are collaborating with forefront organizations of German foreign policy and have been counseling the exile government for several years on questions of German Volksgruppen or ethnic group policies. A member of the current delegation is demanding the secession of South Tyrol along the lines of the Montenegrin model. Those attacks on China's territorial integrity are coming just a few days after the German government launched its anti-Chinese offensive. Berlin is supporting Tibetan separatists also through large-scale lobbying in Mongolia and is seeking to pit the populations of all autonomous regions in Western and northern China against the central government. Similar political concepts date back to the 1920s and are being echoed still today in Japan, the former Axis partner of the German Reich and China's fiercest international rival. Last week, a delegation of North Italian parliamentarians held extensive talks with the Tibetan self-proclaimed exile government at its headquarters in Dharamsala, northern India. This is important for the foreign policy of Germany because South Tyrol has many links to networks of ethnic German Volksgruppen and policy. Franz Paul's party, leader of the delegation, the Südtiroler Volkspartei, or South Tyrolean People's Party, is a member of the Federal Union of European Nationalities, or FUEN, that was founded by Nazi Volksgruppen experts and is today still financed by the German government. This, by the way, is one of the Vertriebene groups, of the groups that were based of Germanic peoples who were exiled at the end of World War II or driven out. And again, these organizations are under the control of the SS. They were formed by the SS at the end of the war. And as we've looked at in some of our programs about Germany, the Vertriebene groups were basically sustained by the German government, and the Südtiroler Volkspartei is one of the Vertriebene groups, and that is one of the groups dealing with the Dalai Lama. Returning once again and repeating part of the last sentence. Franz Paul's party, Leader of the delegation, Franz Paul's party, the Südtiroler Volkspartei, or South Tyrolean People's Party, is a member of the Federal Union of European Nationalities, or FUEN, that was founded by Nazi Volksgruppen experts and is today still financed by the German government. The FUEN is also supported by the autonomous region Trentino, South Tyrol, and the autonomous province of Bozen. The South Tyrol autonomy is patterned after concepts of the German Volksgruppen policy and was re-established after a series of terrorist attacks instigated by German residents. Former South Tyrol terrorists are still sheltered on German soil. All relevant Tibetan exile organizations participated in the talks with the Northern Italian delegation, the exile government, the exile parliament, exile administration, social and cultural associations, as well as the exile's controversial spiritual and worldly leader, the Dalai Lama. For years, Tibetan exiles have been counseled on the ways and means of German Volksgruppen policy in Bolzano, the center of South Tyrolean autonomy. China's occupation of Tibet is illegal, the delegation leader Franz Paul asserted. We support the Tibetan cause and are doing everything in our power to strengthen it, unquote. Tibet for the Tibetan, demanded Eva Klotz, who participated in the delegation. Tibet must be liberated, unquote. Eva Klotz, a member of the regional parliament, is a descendant of an influential family of the Germanophone minority. Only recently, she had been in the news because she demanded South Tyrol's secession from Italy, patterned on the Montenegrin model. The Bolzano-Tibet offensive succeeds the German chancellor's meeting with the Dalai Lama and Prime Minister of Hesse Roland Koch's announcement that Western support for Tibetan separatism will increase before the Olympic Games. Berlin is flanking its activities against Beijing with lobbying projects that at first sight seem to have nothing to do with China, but to gain influence in another sovereign state, Mongolia, and in a section called Raw Materials. This summer, the German government conspicuously intensified its cooperation with Mongolia as well. The German Minister of Economics, Michael Gloss, visited that country in July of 2007, accompanied by a large business delegation. In August, a delegation of managers from the German Asia-Pacific Business Association followed. Already in the first semester of 2007, business between the two countries had increased by approximately one-third. Berlin's business endeavors are focusing particularly on mining cooperation, unquote, according to the Minister of Economy. Mongolia is rich in minerals, copper, and gold deposits. Germany and Mongolia are splendidly supplementing one another, cooed German Parliamentary President Norbert Lammert to his Mongolian counterpart last September. You have the raw materials we need, and we can contribute to your knowledge and technology for the refinement and processing of your raw materials, unquote. From the foreign policy dialogue concluded between Berlin and Ulaanbaatar in April of 2006, it is evident that Berlin's influence is not only directed at a dependent supplier of resources needed by German industry. Possible lines of impact were exposed in a spectacular exhibit inaugurated a year earlier by Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder in the company of the Mongolian Prime Minister in the government's Art and Exhibition Hall in Bonn. With much publicity, the results of German research in Mongolia were presented under the motto, Genghis Khan and his heritage, unquote. This occurred just before the 800th anniversary of the founding of the Greater Mongolian Empire was to be celebrated with much pageantry in Ulaanbaatar in the presence of the German parliamentary president. The exhibition in Bonn also caught the attention in Inner Mongolia, an autonomous region in northern China that holds Genghis Khan in high esteem as the symbol of aspirations of a greater Mongolia. German interests in Mongolia and the Chinese Inner Mongolian region also extend back to the 1920s. Berlin invited the Mongolian Minister of Education to make a tour of Germany in 1924. Ulaanbaatar sent 35 students to Germany for classes in 1926. The goal was to create a long-term, close relationship to counteract Mongolia's strong dependence on Moscow. In 1927, the German Foreign Ministry sent an expedition to Inner Mongolia and Xinjiang, today another autonomous region of China. As recent investigations show, Berlin sent several military personnel camouflaged as researchers to China to accompany the pro-German Swedish scientist Sven Hedin to do espionage in the rebellious minority regions. Both initiatives were unsuccessful. Then, in the spring of 1928, Beijing refused to allow the German military expedition to continue its journey, and due to pressure from Moscow, the Mongolian students had to return home in 1929 and 30. The idea of gaining a foothold in Asia with the cooperation of Mongolia and forces struggling for a greater Mongolia has never been abandoned. As the Wehrmacht continued its eastward advance in 1942 and Japanese troops reached the borders of Tibet, the plans to create a buffer state, a pan-Mongolian federation between the world powers, were reactivated. This federation, comprised of Tibet, seeking to enhance its relations with Berlin, Mongolia, and Inner Mongolia, that in 1937, with the aid of Japan, had won its sovereignty, would be under the hegemony of Germany and Japan. Only the defeat of the World War II aggressors thwarted the application of these plans. Since the mid-1980s, Germany has been actively reviving its traditions of cooperation that had been established by the SS in the 1930s. Relations to Mongolia have been systematically intensified since 1991. Good contacts to Inner Mongolia have mainly been maintained by Berlin's Axis partner, Japan. The three regions are not only united in their aspirations to achieve comprehensive independence from China, they also maintain close cultural ties to one another. Tibetan Buddhism is the main religion in Mongolia and Inner Mongolia, and the religious leader, the Dalai Lama, is highly revered there. As the God King himself explained in a recent interview in the German press, eventual upheavals in Tibet will also have repercussions, unquote, on Inner Mongolia. Berlin's Tibet offensive is not motivated by its concern for a minority culture, as it likes to pretend. It is the repeated attempt to lay hand on about half of the Chinese territory and use its population for the struggle against Beijing. And the purpose of that, of course, is to get their hands on the raw materials. A couple of articles were not a few things that were worth mentioning here. The same sort of a policy of Volksgruppenrechte is being pursued by the UNPO against a large country called the United States. And among the groups whose rights are being championed are those of Native Hawaiians and Native Americans, such as the Lakota. That's not to say that those groups don't have legitimate rights. They do, or that the history of oppression against them is laudable. But again, note that this is using ostensibly good cause for bad purposes, namely for the dissolution and conquest of rival large states. There will be supplemental material to this broadcast in the description two for the record 615, but we have no more time because this concludes side two of For the Record 615, Going Native, Part 2, German Foreign Policy and Its Implications, being recorded on October 21st of 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.